This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Sports are one of the best ways to teach a lot of positive life lessons in a fun and physically engaging way. Teamwork, confidence, sportsmanship, handling failure, skill building, and so much more. So it makes sense why so many families invest in it so heavily with their time and their money. But like all things, there's a line that can easily be breached that can turn a very positive thing quite toxic. Today on the show, we're talking about youth sports, a topic in which the positives far outweigh the negatives, but we'll touch on those this hour too. How has youth sports affected your life? What lasting impacts has it had? And just for fun, what did you play? Comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me in this segment is Tammy Silverman, president and CEO of Indiana Youth Institute. Hi, Tammy.
Hello.
And the co-founder of Indiana Primetime Sports, Ryan Cole. Afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Tammy, can you introduce those of us who may be unfamiliar to the work that Indiana Youth Institute does?
Absolutely. Just quickly, we exist to serve and support anybody in our state that's working with kids. So a lot of times we think of schools, after school programs, but it's also all of these coaches, right? We know these coaches have a huge influence on our kids. So we want to make sure that they have training, data, research, support, organizational capacity if they need it. So we're kind of the ones that feed into and lift up all the organizations and individuals working with kids in our state.
And this month, you penned a piece that highlights the pros and cons of youth sports. Where do sports fit in the conversation around wellness and children?
Well, first and foremost, I think everyone thinks of the health benefits, right, which are obvious. We know that Indiana has an obesity problem with many of our children. So sports are one of those ways that keep kids active, right? Keeps them moving, keeps them going. And at the same time, it also has all of these other academic benefits and social and emotional benefits that I think sometimes we don't think of right off the bat. We know we need to keep our kids active and engaged, but it also pays off in the classroom because the lessons that they learn on the field or on the court translate directly to the classroom and to their emotional well-being as well.
Ryan, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, youth sports does a lot for children, and they've got a lot of opportunities. And I think, from my seat as a coach and as a program director, that we have the ability to provide a lot of opportunities for youth through the avenue of sports.
And you co-founded a youth sports organization, Indiana Primetime Sports, in 2013. You have a background in health and education. Can you talk about how Primetime Sports came to be?
Sure. My partner, Brandon Lafferman, and I both went to Butler University and studied education. We both were teachers out of college. But during college, because we were in education, we had a lot of conversations around the idea of physical, mental, and social development in young kids. And we both were sports fanatics, and we had a great youth experience through our childhood playing sports. And I think our conversations kind of led us to believe that there was something more out there that we could potentially provide for kids in the area, in the community. And because of this, we were in college, and we started our coaching careers, our junior and senior year at Butler. And I think that led us to really an opportunity to launch what was Indiana Primetime Sports. And we didn't really know what we were getting into. We just knew that we wanted to help kids. We wanted to coach, and we wanted to be a part of it. And so our conversations that were really around the development of kids through sports kind of became a reality when we were in college. And then we both went into teaching, and we taught for 3 years. We continued to talk about it. We continued to run our summer camps that we kind of started with. And then 3 years into teaching, we both kind of took a leap of faith and resigned from teaching and decided to run with Indiana Primetime Sports full time.
I imagine as you were building the program, it was important to emphasize not just the aspects of physical achievement, but also mental and social development. How do you approach that?
Absolutely. In our initial mission, we kind of always came back to our mission statement, and we were always concerned with the mental side and the social side of sports and what it could do for a kid. But our goal was to provide the highest quality athletic experience for children, utilizing highly qualified coaches who would develop character, self-esteem, and confidence in the athletes while providing a fun atmosphere that was family friendly. And I think we kind of always came back to that. We always tried to hang our hat on that. That was really, I think, what was able to give us the ability to grow like we did.
You talked about your positive experience growing up playing youth sports, and there are many positive experiences out there among children, but there are some negative ones. From your perspective, what did your parents do right, or what went right with how it was presented to you growing up?
Yeah, my parents, they were awesome. I had a great support system, and they really gave me the ability to try anything I wanted. And Sports became something I was passionate about at a very young age, and my parents never held me back from that. They let me explore different sports at different times, and it eventually became my creative outlet. I wasn't artistic. I wasn't real musical. So that was what really interests me and what I was passionate about. And my parents were not parents that were overbearing. You know, they weren't coaching from the sidelines. They weren't, doing a lot of that. They were just there to support, and they just wanted me to have fun and, tell me they were proud of me when it was over.
I think that's key. And for all the positives that youth can gain from sports, there are some cons to consider, of course. 70% of children drop out of youth sports by age 13, according to research done by the National Alliance for Sports. Among the top reasons for disengagement are, of course, parents and also coaches. Tammy, you've written about some of the pitfalls that parents can fall into in youth sports.
Yes.
What are they?
Well, first and foremost, there's that inclination that because you're the parent, you also need to be the coach, right? And that you can take all the skills and hopes and desires for your child off the field and translate those to them on the field. And yet we know that it's really important that you let the coaches coach, right? And that can be really hard, particularly for those parents who did play sports themselves and that are passionate and they love being part of the game and that sports community. And yet it's critically important that you leave that to the coaches and that, as Ryan said, you're there just to be that positive, supportive. Let them know it's part of exploration, right? That there's no directives. The other one is it said, I think what the actual research said was stop using the sports sidelines as your social circle or as your social time, therefore putting pressure on the kid that, this is something we all do together. Again, let them explore and have fun. It can be social, right? You can show up and have a good time. And we often see, I'm a sports parent, so we see a lot of the same families there all the time, but that's not the reason you're there. You're there to support your child. Last one, which was overwhelming, consistent across all the articles and research, was the fact that so many parents put the pressure on that you're going to get a college scholarship out of this. And the reality is only 2% of kids who play sports in high school go on to get an athletic scholarship to play in college. So again, focus on what the realities are, what those benefits are, because the benefits are real and they're substantial. It's probably not going to be a college scholarship.
Yeah, don't bank on it.
Correct.
And
absolutely.
And we see that sort of thing all the time. You also acknowledge that, hey, youth sports aren't the perfect fit for every child, and it's important to recognize that.
It is. And I think, Ryan said it perfectly, that was his outlet. And for other kids, they can have different outlets. And just because you as a parent might have been an avid fill-in-the-blank football player, basketball, volleyball, tennis, whatever that is, doesn't mean your child is going to have the same passion for that sport. And so give them the creativity, give them the freedom to find what's right for them.
I think some of the ways in which parents respond a little strongly comes from maybe their experience. Maybe they played the exact same sport. They saw what they perceived as their mistakes, and they want to try to mitigate that, and they just get way too involved. Ryan, you must see that all the time.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges that we have come across in our 10-plus years of doing this, and it's the parents coaching from the sidelines and having to really kind of work through that with the parents and not let them understand that a lot of times that is not what is best for their child, and they just need to let them be within the game and let their coach. And afterwards, if there's something they need to say or they have an opinion, that's the time to talk to their child about it, and not during the game, not in the middle of the game. We see a lot of children that will, in the middle of a game, look over to mom and dad in the stands for approval. And it's amazing how many kids do that on the basketball court, football field, baseball field. It's something that we try to address at our, team meetings and set the expectations early. But it's something that is programmed into these kids through the way these parents have handled them in the early stages, that it's something that it's just a challenge for a lot of coaches.
And there is quite literally a generational divide. I mean, the way parents were coached is very different from the way kids are coached now because of things that we've learned. Do you have examples of maybe the way things are done now versus the way they were done 25 years ago?
Well, I think the landscape of sports has changed over the last 25 years, and I think that's the biggest key. I think when we were young, it was you played, 8 weeks of Little League, then you went to your next sport for 8 weeks, and you just kind of evolved, and now it's 14 baseball tournaments or softball tournaments a year, and it's travel baseball, travel softball, travel basketball, and it's become this large model that within the landscape of sports that it's just more, more, more. And I think because of that, there's more investment from the parents, which causes them to feel like they should be more involved. And I think that's where we get into a little trouble. I think when parents used to just, you know, send their child to Little League, they could sit in the stands, have a hot dog, and enjoy their time. And now I think everything is more competitive. And I think because of the money that people are paying, that sometimes influences them to act the way they do.
Tammy, you talked about training for coaches. What does that training look like?
Well, and I think, you know, it really does evolve around what are you trying to teach? What are you training? Of course, you want to know the logistics and all the rules and all of those things and the skills, but you're also trying to raise young people to be good citizens, right? To learn what it means to win well and what it means to lose and what it means to be part of a team and how to communicate and all of those other great skills that you have as a coach have the ability to influence. So it's not just about coaching great basketball players or baseball players. It's about helping to raise the next generation of young people and do that in a really positive environment.
And I think that that this conversation is very important. Ryan, how do you instill those character traits that we hear about in sports? That's hard to do overnight. What are the keys to doing that?
Well, I think first you have to be intentional. And I think all coaches, if they're not intentional in what they're doing and what their practice plan is and how they're approaching certain situations, it's going to be really hard to instill these characteristics. So for us, and me personally as a coach, I always have a plan. And if it's to help these children learn how to overcome adversity, I'm going to put them in an adverse situation where they're going to fail. And then they have to learn how to overcome that, bounce back from it, and do it in a way that is positive. And I think being intentional is truly the way to do it. We also coach our coaches. So we oversee a lot of different coaches in many different sports. And if they don't understand kind of the main goal of being in a position where we can raise young athletes into, you know, positive citizens in the community, then we're not doing our job.
I'm so glad we're talking about this today, and even more pleased that we invited you to here to chat. Tammy Silverman, President and CEO of Indiana Youth Institute, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ryan Cole, co-founder of Indiana Primetime Sports, thanks for what you do. We appreciate you coming by.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk about the differences between kids who play and kids who don't, and why some communities are better represented than others in the world of youth sports. And we'll talk about the big money some families spend annually on youth sports. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What did or do you like about participating in youth sports? What's not so fun about it? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the topic of youth sports, I want to remind you about our topic alerts. This is a small, short email you'll receive the morning of the show, letting you know what the show is going to be about. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter for the same information. You can find us at All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about the vibrant culture of youth sports in Indiana. And, of course, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. We especially want to hear from you if youth sports has had an impact on your life, good or bad. Right now, we welcome Associate Professor at IUPUI and Director of the Sports Innovation Institute, David Pierce. David, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Molly Wright, Senior Director of Youth Programming at Indiana Sports Corps. Molly, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Molly, let's jump in. We were just discussing the variety of benefits that many youth gain from participating in sports. However, there's also a discrepancy between youth that participate and those who don't. Urban areas and underprivileged areas tend to have lower rates of participation. How does Indiana Sports Corps work to mend those gaps?
Sure. So we provide a lot of free opportunities for youth-serving organizations and for teachers in schools to participate in any of our programming around the events that we host in Indianapolis, i.e. maybe the Big Ten Football Championship or basketball, where we're doing a football clinic to teach kids the game, a non-contact, and maybe we're offering a basketball clinic. And then on the flip side of it, we're also doing things to help kids get jobs. So we're doing officials clinics and things like that. So everything we do is for free.
It seems like that's a very sort of, and I forgive the term, but it seems like a holistic approach.
You're
kind of, it's sort of general life skills.
Right. Yeah.
What are some of the programs that the Inspiring Sports Grant program has been able to fund?
So the Inspiring Sports Grant is one of our longest standing grants. It's for a non-mainstream sport activity for a youth-serving organization or a teacher. So providing opportunities for those kids that might not otherwise have an opportunity to do, let's say, yoga. Maybe they want to bring in a yoga instructor. Maybe they're going to take them to a camp and do horseback riding. Maybe they're going to teach them golf, which also teaches them leadership skills and keeps them active and fit and things like that. So it's total grant opportunity for youth organizations.
You'll be continuing to fund more programs like this in the future, I would imagine?
Yep. So that grant opportunity is actually open now, along with our sports equipment grant. So we do have a $2,000 sports equipment grant that is open right now also. They close at the end of October.
Why is it important for this funding to go toward youth sports?
A lot of it is, as you had mentioned, just providing an opportunity for kids that might not otherwise have it to help them stay active and fit. And not only is it teaching the kids the sport, but it's teaching them those leadership skills. How do they receive direction from an adult? And it could help them in the future, too.
And what kind of feedback do you hear from either the youth who are participating or the parents that benefit from these programs?
We work directly with the youth organization or with the teacher that's providing these opportunities for the kids. And typically it is a large thank you for all the things that we provide for them, because these kids just wouldn't otherwise have that opportunity to do so.
Programs like these can definitely benefit the individual athletes in very obvious and tangible ways, but they also have an impact on the community.
Right. Yep. So there's a great opportunity for volunteers to get involved in the things that we do, just to kind of open their eyes. And we do site visits to all those grants I was talking about. So it opens up the eyes of the staff members of Sports Corp to see what it is that impact that they're having on the community and these kids. Maybe it's a program that's doing swim lessons and they're teaching kids to swim, or they're teaching them to ride a bike, which is a life skill.
David, you're the director of the Sports Innovation Institute at IUPUI, through which a number of fascinating studies around youth sports have come out. Can you talk a little bit about what the Sports Innovation Institute does?
Yeah, sure. So, we've got a variety of different things going on, but as it relates to the students that engage with us, we're really passionate about giving them opportunities to innovate. And one of those areas that we have found particularly useful is in youth sports. So we're talking about a $17 billion industry, right? It's the fastest growing industry in all of travel and tourism. So there's a lot of money being spent, right? And then locally, a lot of great facilities. But in particular, we're really passionate about getting our students out in the field and then really using design thinking and human-centered design as a framework to innovate programming, activities, and experiences in the youth sports space.
$17 billion. When I hear something like that, I wonder about the days when I was growing up, and it was just, parents organizing T-ball and Little League and things like that, and now it seems to be sort of turning into big business. Does that concern you in any way?
Well, I wouldn't say it's concerning. Ideally, if it's done well, it's going to make it better,
yeah.
Right? It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. So we look at like the whole ecosystem that's kind of cropped up around youth sports, right? Everything from the travel experience to equipment and uniforms to software and technology to registration platforms to, Molly and I were talking about the importance of getting more sports officials. And there's a declining number of those around, right? And so there's a whole ecosystem that's kind of developed around youth sport.
Project Play is an initiative through the Aspen Institute, an international nonprofit working to identify and address the decline in youth involved in team sports. Has the Sports Innovation Institute taken a look at that?
Yeah. So actually in our intro to sport management class, kind of the first class that students take, they do a project all geared around the Project Play data, just to kind of wet the whistle a little bit and get exposed to the great research that's out there. Project Play is great at raising awareness about the issue. It's great about publishing research. But we want to get students to think beyond that and really to think about, well, what are we going to do about it?
Project Play prescribes 8 plays, quote unquote, or strategies that stakeholders in youth sports can consider. Can you tell us what some of those plays look like and if any are applicable to Indiana?
Yeah, sure. So one of the plays is just to ask kids what they want, right? So the idea, and this is perfect for design thinking, where you're really going out and trying to understand what users in a neighborhood or a community actually want. So the big picture here is, how do you get adults out of it and get kids into it?
Ah.
right? And so in some of the research that's been published here, the kids will rank winning way down at the bottom, but they'll rank having fun way at the top in terms of what they want out of their experience, right? Another one of the plays is to reintroduce free play. So what are the sports that are going to really spur creativity and passion in the game? Again, it's, you know, how do we reduce the amount of influence that adults are having and how kids structure their time?
What are some examples of that?
Yeah. So if I think about, and Molly and I were talking this before, I think of a sport like futsal. Right. So basically, it's a small field soccer game, slightly smaller balls, slower goals. It's 5-on-5. There's a lot more action. There's a lot more activity. Very popular in the Latino community. One of the other plays that's related here, too, would be using small spaces. Right. So, we don't always need to have, 40 soccer fields in one place, like up at Grand Park, to be able to have kids to be physically active. How do we do it in more of a neighborhood context? And that's really important because the, income, unfortunately, is a significant predictor of youth sport participation.
We talked earlier with Ryan Cole, who co-founded his own youth sports organization, and the Sports Innovation Institute has published pieces that really outline exactly what a business youth sports have become. In fact, youth sports tourism has become a multi-billion-dollar a year segment within the tourism industry.
Yep.
What is youth sports tourism?
Yeah, so the term that is being coined or is talked about in the space is the term tournication. Mm-hmm. So it's the folks that are out there combining essentially their vacation time with competing in tournaments with their kids, right? So they're called the tournicationer. And so a facility like Grand Park, when they bring in national level soccer and lacrosse events, really caters to that group. So a recent study published in the USA Today said that 2 out of 10 families that participate in youth sport are spending at least $10,000 a year on these tournication experiences.
Wow.
And some more than $20,000. That was like 8% of the
study. And your research points to some parents spending as much as $20,000 a year to take their children to youth sporting events, often making it anywhere from 10 to 30 trips a year. Why does this cost so much? What are they spending this money on?
Well, so we broke it down locally into like 5 different buckets. So the median amount that parents are spending in the Indianapolis community based on 500 respondents in the local market, our folks here in Indy, the median was about $3,200 a year. But what they spend it on is registration and participation fees, all of the travel expenses, hotel, gas, air travel, equipment and uniforms, coaching is a big one. Obviously, sports, rehab, and therapy. So a lot of different things in the medical. Again, that's part of that full, ecosystem. Different facility fees and tournament registration fees would be kind of the big buckets that parents are spending that money on.
If I'm a mayor, I'm hearing this and seeing dollar signs when I blink, and I just think, how is it affecting the communities that host these weekend tournaments?
Well, ideally, it would be in a positive way. So ideally, you've got out-of-town visitors, folks that are not from the local community that are traveling in, and they're spending their money on restaurants, they're spending their money on entertainment. The real challenge for communities, in another study we did, we basically found that people don't really do any research about the site that they're going to beforehand. So kind of what does your onboarding experience as a community look like as you try to get information in people's hands? And the other thing is time is tight. And people are stuck at the ball fields most of the weekend. So tournaments maybe go Thursday to Sunday, but a lot of them are Friday to Sunday. And if you're playing 8-9 games in that time, you'd end up with a situation where, people are in your community, but are they really getting outside the facility to spend their money, which is where the economic impact would occur. Outside of the hotel stay, of course.
But at the same time, local businesses do look to capitalize on and cater to these events. And in what ways?
Yeah. So, ideally, that's where a community is working together and they've got a really good marketing message and they're communicating that information effectively so that people don't find out about all the really cool things they could have done just about the time that they're leaving. So that's really the problem area that we found in a couple of the communities that we've done some research in is that folks find out about these things basically when it's time to go.
In May of last year, Sports Innovation Institute surveyed parents in Central Indiana, and the average amount they spent on youth sports annually was still pretty high, more than $3,000. A lot of trips to the concession stand. Parents also spent an average of 19 hours per week in season at their child's sporting events. That's like a second part-time job.
Yeah, that number, that is an interesting number. So, yeah, so 19 hours a week spent in season. And when we're talking about the folks that answered that their kid was on a travel team, that 19 hours a week, like in season is all the time.
Right.
Right. So that, I mean, that's the other thing to think. We think of seasons in terms of, you know, 8 to 12 week bursts. But for that group, that 30% group that was in the kind of that travel competitive cohort, there really were no seasons. That was just across the board for the year.
What are the driving factors behind this level of involvement? Do people just love travel and sports, or do some view this as an investment in a college scholarship, like we talked about in the first segment?
I think they do.
I wonder how many of them are counting on it, though.
I know that is a good question. That is a good question. Yeah, Molly, do you want to? I think people are definitely doing that. I guess personally, I take the route of I just put that in the 529 and pay for college that way. I guess it kind of ends up being about the same amount of money when you, or maybe even less when you do the math on it. Molly, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, mine would just be personal thoughts because I do have 5 children, all who play sports, none of which are doing travel yet because they're younger, so they're 1st through 4th grade. But I mean, ideally, we're teaching them to study hard and to do their best in all aspects of their life, which would include sports. And if that college scholarship comes along, I think that's an added bonus for what they're trying, the effort that they're putting in.
Molly, can you talk about your ticket exchange program?
Sure. So a lot of our sports partners offer us community block tickets that we post online through the exchange, which is our online community, which is free to register if you're a teacher or a school or a youth serving organization. So, for example, the Indy 11 give us 200 tickets to every game, and we try to provide those to youth organizations and just, again, provide another opportunity for kids to get into a stadium that they might not otherwise have the opportunity to do. If that organization needs help with transportation and whatnot, then we're able to help them there.
Why do you think youth sports are treasured by so many people in Indiana?
I think it's just being able to provide the youth. So somebody who is influential in a child's life is trying to provide opportunities for kids and just teach them those life lessons, whether it's how to ride a bike, that might be their main area of transportation, or maybe they're getting them an opportunity to go into Banker's Life and see a college basketball player and say, hey, you know, this could be you if you study hard and you work hard and you play hard and all of those things come together, because maybe they're not getting that information at home. So they need to be encouraged by a teacher or a director.
Let's come back to that issue of the shortage with sports officials, shortage of sports officials. What's happening with that? How is that being addressed?
So one of our missions at Sports Corp actually is to help kids get jobs. So a couple of years ago, our president, Ryan Vaughn, came in and said, Indy Parks is short by 300 lifeguards. What can we do? And I said, well, let's pay for their certification. So that's kind of where it started. So we're into our 5th year of helping kids become lifeguards. And then what Dave and I were just talking about is we're doing a free football officials clinic for high school and college age kids around the Big Ten football championship game. Free to attend. Kids that are 18 and older that can be background screened will then actually receive their certification. We give them their jersey. We help them with their assigners and things like that. But there's definitely a shortage across many sports.
David, what else is the Sports Innovation Institute exploring right now?
Well, actually, so this semester in my senior capstone class, which is a part of the Institute, we are actually going to look at the recruitment and retention of sports officials. So perfect timing for the conversation with Molly. I just took a bunch of notes on everything they're doing. Molly's now going to come into my class on a couple of Friday mornings and watch my students pitch their ideas at the end of the semester. But that is actually what the senior capstone class is going to do. So we're going to get out there. We're going to observe officials. We're going to interview officials. We're going to interview stakeholders. It is such a, you know, so many different stakeholder groups are impacted, from the National Federation of High Schools to the IHSAA, to local youth sport organizations, to the Sports Corp, to the NCAA, to conference commissioners. I mean, it really impacts. And the bottom line is, I just think people don't think about the officials that show up. You just, well, there's a game, it's on my schedule, and these people in stripes are going to be there. But you never think about, where did that person come from, right? Why are they here? Why are they doing this? And what is it that I'm doing that might make them not want to come back, right? So my students haven't, we haven't dug in. Today's the first day of the semester. Class meets Friday. But if you just, you know, read the popular press on it, you know, parent behavior is a big deal as it relates to people dropping out of sports officiating. So My challenge to everybody listening to this show, and I just did it for the first time this weekend at my kids' football game, no matter what happens in the game, if we're talking, I'm talking youth, not like a high school game, but if it's a youth sporting event and there's officials, just go up and shake their hand and tell them thank you when the game's over. That could make a big difference in whether or not people want to come back and do it again.
In the last few seconds that we have, David, do you see development of programs that exist sort of in the middle of the commitment spectrum? We talk about the all-in families.
One of the things we found last semester in a project was there's really a space for innovation and new programming and development in what some clubs are now calling like the Rec Plus model, and that can either come from the club or that can club from the rec sports organization. But it's the parents that are like, I think my kid is maybe aging out of the rec, and we want to maybe dip our toe in the water, but what does that next step look like? So I think if there's clubs or youth sport organizations that can deliver really quality programming there, I think that is where they can kind of innovate their business model a little bit.
David Pierce, director of the Sports Innovation Institute. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And Molly Wright, Senior Director of Youth Programming at Indiana Sports Corp. Thank you for your time.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear about the factors that drive some kids away from youth sports. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on youth sports. We're joined now by Dana Benbow. She's a sports reporter at the Indianapolis Star. Dana, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. This is Dana Benbow. She's a sports reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Dana, your recent reporting has followed the trend of youth athletes specializing in one sport rather than playing several throughout the year. And how long has this trend been developing?
You know, it's one of those things that's kind of developed slowly, maybe starting the past couple decades, but of late with all the club sports, AAU, it's really, really taken off. It actually is traced back to a study by a psychologist back in the 1990s, and he came up with this 10,000-hour rule, and he said anybody who wants to be an expert and really good at anything needs to practice it for 10,000 hours. And so that was supposed to be regarding, you know, these musicians in Germany playing the violin, but, you know, I think some of these athletes kind of took it over to the sports segment and took it a little bit more seriously.
Why is it that fewer kids are playing multiple sports and instead focusing on one or two?
Oh, well, I think colleges definitely are looking for that year-round athlete. I mean, that's where most of the scouting is done in high school, or at the summer leagues, not necessarily at high schools. Especially maybe in swimming and soccer, where sometimes they're just focusing only on club and not even doing school sports, because that's where the scouting's done. But of course, sports medicine experts say the more repetition you have doing the exact same sport, the worse it is on your body and your mind.
And we're not talking about bumps and bruises here. We're talking about kids as young as 12 and 13 undergoing serious sports-related surgeries, correct?
Yeah, I talked to four or five. Actually, I had talked to some of these guys about Andrew Luck's injury, believe it or not. And as I was talking to them several months ago, they were talking about this. It's called pitcher shoulder little league surgery. The biggest and two most prevalent injuries in youth sports are ACL tears to the knee due to year-round basketball, and then pitchers' arms and shoulders due to pitching so much year-round. And so one of them has seen a kid as young as 11. He started at 3, and of course pitching doesn't even start till 8 or 9 by a kid, but the parents had him working out at 4 and 5 pitching, and he was like 11 and undergoing the knife to have his shoulder repaired. So it's really alarming when you think about that.
I'm glad you brought up Andrew Luck, because here's an example of someone who played very well, obviously, in high school and then in college, and then got to the NFL and had two or three good seasons, but then has been sort of mired in injury. And, of course, the big announcement this past weekend that he left. I can't imagine what it's like for a kid who's sort of sidelined from the game before they even have that opportunity.
I know. If you saw in the story, there were four on one high school basketball team last year with torn ACLs at Brownsburg, all played the high school team and four of them tore their ACLs. I mean, that's just staggering to me that on one small varsity basketball girls team, you had four of them with torn ACLs. And I talked to the coach about it, and, you know, the one girl was their starting point guard for her freshman year, and the night before sectional, she tore her ACL. They were ranked somewhere in the top 10 in the state, and they didn't have their best player for sectionals. And so for that girl to have to sit out and watch that, I mean, that's awful young. You know, a sophomore, 16 years old, and, you know, the team's depending on you, and it's kind of a smaller version of Andrew Luck, but for in her world, it's everything. And so, you know, the sports medicine surgeons are saying, you know, play year-round if you want, but mix up the sports. You know, do some swimming instead of, you know, playing basketball year-round, although those are usually the same season. But you know what I'm saying. You know, run track. You know, instead of playing basketball all spring, go out for the track team and do some cardio and, you know, that kind of stuff. So just don't use those same muscles and tendons and bones over and over.
Have you looked into the challenges that doctors face in communicating some of these concerns to parents?
Yeah, I talked to one at Peyton Manning Children's Hospital, and he said, he had the best quote. He said, they look at me like I have six heads. He said, I'll call these parents, and he'll even ask for the coach's phone numbers, because he had one kid who threw 150 pitches, I think I don't remember the exact time frame, but it was way too many, and the coach just really wanted to win. He was supposed to be like a relief pitcher, but he was so good, he thought, I'll have him throw his 95 miles an hour the whole game. So it was, he said he called the coach, he called the parents in, and the parents, and they just looked at him like he was crazy. He said they just, because it hasn't happened to their child yet, or maybe the injury's not quite ready for surgery, or, you know, they think, oh, they're young, you know. And actually, I found out something I had no idea, that actually young people take longer to recuperate than older people, because their bones and muscles are still forming, so they need a couple more days rest than we do.
And we're going to have to
leave as in old people.
And we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you for your patience with our technical issues. Dana Benbow, thank you for your reporting as well and taking the time to chat with us.
Yep, have a good one.
Dana's a sports reporter for the Indianapolis Star. We will hear now from Craig Mintz from the Athenaeum Foundation on a big event happening there this weekend. This may be a show about Indiana, but we're going to leave the state, the planet, and the galaxy for a few minutes to talk about one far, far away. The original Star Wars trilogy is coming to an Indianapolis theater for the first time in two decades. I'm here with Athenaeum Foundation President Craig Mintz. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
You're a big Star Wars fan.
I am.
I'm finding out. And so when can Hoosier fans get their OT, their original trilogy?
The original, the Holy Trilogy.
Four, five, and six.
It'll be this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We'll be playing it in sequential order. So New Hope at 7 o'clock on Thursday, Empire Strikes Back on Friday at 7, and Return of the Jedi on Saturday at 7 o'clock.
Now, you're sitting across the table from a big Star Wars fan.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have time to get into how huge, but I've never invested in screen-accurate costumes, unlike some of the people who are going to be attending this event. Who's coming this weekend?
So a local organization called the 501st. This is a group of enthusiasts that have Lucas's blessing on actually being publicly at events in specific costumes. Stormtroopers, Vader, Kylo Ren, Chewbacca, R2, all these guys, they go through a vetting process and get kind of the thumbs up from Lucas himself, and they can actually go out and be part of these events.
But even though they sort of are there in an official capacity,
mm-hmm.
and are sort of representing,
mm-hmm.
you would say you would encourage other people to come in costume as
well,
right?
Oh, most definitely. You know, you want people to enjoy themselves. You know, we do ask on site, you know, masks need to come off during the show.
Sure.
You know, gun or blaster representations, probably not a good idea, given today's day and age. Lightsabers, totally cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we want people to come and have a good time and have a lot of fun.
Do you yourself dress up, or have you?
I won't answer that question. No, actually, I'm typically working these things, so I never really get to dress up.
So this hasn't happened in a while, and for good reason. You know, showing Star Wars, the original trilogy, it's not easy to get the rights to this.
It was impossible up until about 2-3 months ago in a very small window. And it's in a non-theatrical capacity, so you couldn't show them in a traditional movie theater, which was perfect because I have a theater that is not a movie theater. So it was, as soon as I heard about it, I jumped at it.
Well, what did you have to go through to make that happen? I mean,
surprisingly, a lot of approvals. We had to go through the distributor. We had to go through Lucas. We had to get approvals on everything that we did, both from a creative, you know, in a, you know, a literal sense as far as the, you know, the aesthetics of, you know, all of our materials, what we were saying. And, you know, rightfully so, that's kind of Lucas's baby, right? So they want to make sure that, you know, it's represented properly. And, you know, again, it's a very special, you know, opportunity to see these movies kind of in a theater setting. It's not been done in 20-plus years. You know, they do play the symphony. It's a little different. It's a really neat experience. But if you want to just go see the movie in a theater, this is like the first time it's been done in a long time.
Whose idea was this? Was this yours?
Oh yeah, I've worked in the theater exhibition industry for a long time, and been a Star Wars fan. You know, I had been at the IMAX for 17 years. You know, showing the Star Wars movies, seeing the fan base grow again. You know, and it's always been a dream of mine. Sadly, to actually show the original trilogy. You know, it was one of those kind of brass rings that you always try to reach for, but you can never get. I would every year check in with, you know, the folks at Fox and Lucas and see, can we do it this year? Can we make it happen? And it just always turned down. So it's really a career highlight to be able to show these movies to the Indianapolis audience.
Now, in addition to showing the movies and having people in costume, you're also going to have themed food and cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Can we get a sneak preview of some of those items?
Yeah. So at the bar, we're going to have both adult and non-adult drinks, versions of blue milk for both, obviously for the little ones and for the adults.
Excellent.
The adults will have alcohol.
How what's the booze in the blue milk?
You know, that's a good question. My bartenders are working on the recipes right now.
Blue Curacao, perhaps?
Probably,
maybe just
throwing
some vodka in there.
I just put it in front of me, and if it's blue, I'll drink it. We've got Yoda soda. We're going to do a Dark and Stormy Trooper at the bar. And then down at Coat Check Coffee, if you've ever been to the Athenaeum, Coat Check Coffee is located on our first floor. They're playing along because they're big Star Wars fans. And they're going to have, you know, blue lattes. They're going to have Wookiee cookies. They're going to have, after I think it's 6 o'clock, they switch their menu over to an exclusive Star Wars themed menu.
Now, for people who haven't been to the Vestial Theater, what can they expect? How will this be different from seeing a movie at the multiplex?
It's vastly different. It's actually one of the city's oldest theaters. It was built in 1897 with the second half of the Athenaeum. It used to be a 700-person, you know, auditorium, and it's stunning. I mean, it's absolutely stunning, and a majority of the city has never even stepped foot in it. So as soon as you walk in, you just have this air of reverence. You're just like, oh my gosh, where am I right now? And to be able to see a movie like Star Wars in a setting like this is just going to blow your mind.
700 seats, is that how many people are coming to each Star Wars?
No, that was original. It had gone through some changes in the 80s, so we seat 400. So we've got about 400 seats for the crowd, and it's going to make for a nice showing.
So if you want to come, you better get your tickets now.
Yeah, we're offering a trilogy pass. It's actually at a discounted rate, and you get first admission to grab your seat, so you get a few minutes before everybody else to come in and pick your seats. Those are going pretty quickly, and then individual tickets are moving quickly as well.
Let's talk about the Athenaeum itself and of course, the Vestial Theater. Mm-hmm. Indianapolis residents know the YMCA and the Rathskeller and the other tenants and the other establishments there. What are some things that people are surprised to learn about the history of the building?
You know, the building, again, built in 1894 for the gym side, 1897-98 for the rest of the building, was built as kind of like a German community center is probably the best way to put it. The original founders of the building, the Turners, were gymnasts. So they built the gym as a school for gymnastics. And the Turner organization as a whole actually has a motto called a sound mind and a sound body. So they saw fitness and mental health and entertainment and food as being a big holistic approach to life. So the building was kind of this amazing, you know, place, destination for the community to come and gather and work out, do gymnastics, go have dinner in the Rathskeller, and then go see a play up in the theater. It's fascinating, and I've only been in the job for about 9 months now, but the more I learn, the more I'm like, wow, what a treasure this is for the city.
An old building like that has to have some secrets, right?
Oh,
curious
tons.
Rooms, interesting stories. I know there's a ghost hunt coming up on
September
7th.
You know, notoriously known as being haunted, but not in a negative sense. You know, even since I've been there, I have, you know, had those tingles on the back of my neck. You're kind of looking around the corner if it's early in the morning or late at night. So we do quite a few ghost hunts. This one coming up in September is an overnight. So you actually come in and you spend – you don't sleep, obviously, but you spend the evening in the wee hours of the morning, like navigating the building, getting access to rooms that you wouldn't normally get access to, and doing paranormal research with some other paranormal enthusiasts. But yeah. To cross-franchise, I always like to say that the Athenaeum's a lot like Hogwarts. There's stairs and doors everywhere. There are rooms that I've not even been into, and it's fascinating.
So is there anything else that people need to know about the Star Wars screenings? I think we covered everything, but $15 a night if you're just going to one, and then there's the $40 for the three-pack, right?
Yep.
And everything's at 7 p.m.
Everything's at 7 p.m. We're going to have costume characters with the 501st. So come bring your cameras, bring your phones, get your pictures taken with Vader's going to be there. We've got some stormtroopers that are going to be there. And I believe some droids are going to be on site as well. Come in costume if you'd like. And just come have fun. Bring the kids if they've never seen Star Wars, which is kind of strange at this point. But come share the community. Like, this is going to be a lot of fun. So, yeah.
Eventbrite is the website.
Actually, if you just go to our website, athenaeumfoundation.org, there's links on the homepage that'll take you to get tickets.
The original Star Wars trilogy at the Athenaeum's Bessiel Theater this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Athenaeum Foundation President Craig Mintz, thank you so much, and may the Force be with you.
And with you.